Good evening, everyone. It is with great pleasure that I welcome you to the Monterey Conference Center for the 17th annual Leon Panetta Lecture Series. Time goes by quickly. I'm happy to be here with you tonight as we begin an exciting group of discussions that we have prepared for this year. As you know, the purpose of this lecture series has always been to better inform and educate the people of the Central Coast, and through our radio and television broadcasts, the people of California, both live and rebroadcast. This season, we take our lessons from history and we ask, is the past prologue to the future? This year is the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War I. It was a century ago that an isolated act of terrorism in the Balkans pulled the entire world into a prolonged armed conflict that forever changed the face of this globe. Today, the stories of the Ukraine suggest that this region may once again be a powder keg that threatens peace on a worldwide scale. Beyond the tensions in the Ukraine, many of the elements responsible for the Great War are powerfully present today. We see the rise of nationalism, persistent acts of terrorism, complex interwoven alliances, and strategic rivalries. Even as we turn our eyes to Crimea, we must still be wary of the threats posed by North Korea, tensions with China over the South China Sea, civil war in Syria, persistent threats from Al-Qaeda, and the dangers of nuclear proliferation and cyber attack. What have we learned about war and peace in the 100 years that have passed? How has war changed? How has diplomacy changed? Are there lessons our leaders can learn about the power of diplomacy? Can new military technologies and approaches provide greater protection? What are our options, and where do we draw the line? Tonight, Secretary Panetta will pose these questions to three top military, defense, and diplomatic experts. Our first guest is the longest-serving global combatant commander in recent American military history. Widely recognized for his expertise in strategy, tactics, diplomacy, national security, and strategic communications, he has played an influential role in virtually every operation in recent military history. The United States mission in Afghanistan, to protecting Turkish citizens near the border of Syria, to ballistic missile attacks, to NATO operations in Libya, and spearheading cyber security initiatives. Please welcome Admiral James Stavridis.
Thank you.
Our second guest is the former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, where she served as the principal advisor to the Secretary of Defense in the formulation of national security and defense policy, oversight of military plans and operations, and in National Security Council deliberations. She represented the department before Congress and in the media, as well as in dozens of foreign policy discussions. In 2007, she co-founded the Center for a New American Security, a nonpartisan think tank dedicated to developing strong, pragmatic, and principled national security policies. Please welcome Michelle Flournoy. Our final guest tonight is considered one of the most distinguished career diplomats of our time. He held posts throughout the Middle East and was ambassador to Greece and NATO. He has served on the National Security Council, where he was director for Soviet affairs, Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasian affairs. As Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, he led negotiations on a number of key agreements on nuclear disarmament and was the lead negotiator on Iran's nuclear program. Please welcome Ambassador Nicholas Burns.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, moderating the discussion is the man who created this lecture series 17 years ago, the chairman of the Panetta Institute, former director of the CIA, and former Secretary of Defense, and a whole lot of other things. This is a topic he knows well, beginning with his early years in the Army to his time at the CIA and the Department of Defense. Please welcome Secretary Leon Panetta.
Thank you and welcome to the 17th annual lecture series, Panetta Lecture Series. It is without question great to be home. Great to be 3,000 miles from Washington. Great to have as distinguished a panel as we have this evening to discuss some really important topics in our time. As all of you know, the theme that we set for this year was the fact that we celebrate in this year, 2014, 100 years since the beginning of World War I in 1914. And at the time that I set that, I thought it would be interesting to talk about it. I didn't realize how relevant it would be to the events that are taking place today. World War I, you know, we know what the ingredients were at the time. Ingredients of nationalism, terrorism, territorial claims, strategic rivalries between the great powers, misjudgments that took place that led ultimately to the one event that really set off the war, which was the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand. Today, in 2014, a lot of those same ingredients are in the world. We're seeing nationalism, we're seeing terrorism, we're seeing territorial claims, witness what's happening in Crimea. We're seeing issues that really raise the question of whether, you know, we may be at the brink of another Cold War between the United States and Russia. And it raises the issues of misjudgments. Misjudgments regarding the flashpoints around the world. There are a lot of flashpoints in the world that we're dealing with today, and we'll talk about some of those flashpoints. But I want to begin with the Ukraine and what has happened in the Ukraine. Putin obviously has moved into the Crimea with Russian forces. There will be an election within the next few days. I think it's March 16th, where it's likely the decision will be to secede from the Ukraine. The United States world community is looking at sanctions, looking at ways to try to do what they can to stop Russia from proceeding with what they're doing. Bottom line probably is that it's likely we've lost the Crimea. And if that's true, at least in the short term, then I guess the question for all of you is, where does this take us, ultimately? Is this an issue that will be resolved peacefully, or is what Putin's doing ultimately going to lead to a greater confrontation between the United States and Russia? Nick? With you.
Mr. Secretary, thank you. And I just want to say, first of all, thank you for the invitation to be with you. And all of you know Secretary Panetta, but he's had an extraordinary career of public service, extraordinary career in his breadth and diversity. And so I'm really pleased to be with you and pleased to be with good friends. I think that this may turn out to be the most important security crisis in Europe since the end of the Cold War, which was December 25th, 1991, the day the Soviet Union imploded. And perhaps the most important challenge for President Obama in foreign and national security policy in his presidency. It could turn out to be that way. And the reason I say that is because we won something just profoundly important at the end of the Cold War. And we didn't just win it. The people of Eastern Europe liberated themselves. But we won, in the words of President George H.W. Bush, president at the time, a Europe whole, free, and at peace. He also said we had a democratic peace in Europe. It was everything Europe had not been for hundreds of years, particularly in the 20th century, when our soldiers went over to fight in the First and Second World War and the Cold War. So what's meaningful about Ukraine in this event is that that peace has been disrupted. And if Putin goes further and tries to protect the ethnic Russians in Donetsk and Kharkiv and eastern Ukraine, he'll separate and divide Ukraine, and Europe, in a sense, will be divided. And his strategic ambition is this. He wants to build a belt of buffer states around Russia to protect Russia in his 20th century Soviet mentality, zero sum, if you win, I lose, and vice versa. And so he's intimidating Ukraine because they wanted a trade agreement with the EU. And he's intimidating Moldova and Belarus and Georgia and Armenia. And we don't have a security guarantee to Ukraine. Ukraine's not part of NATO. So we're not going to fight Putin over Ukraine. And that's the right decision that President Obama's made. But we have a real stake in the principle that a European democracy ought to be able to decide which way it's looking, west or east. And that's what Putin can't abide in his strategic policy. So the principle's big, and the president's got a big job. He's going to have to lead the world and lead NATO in pushing back, not militarily, against Putin, but isolating him, weakening him, so that in the end, hopefully, the Ukrainian people will have a choice.
Michelle?
No, I would agree with Nick's assessment, and I want to add my thanks to you for hosting us all and really for hosting this conversation, because these issues are so important to the well-being of all Americans, really. I think that it's likely that Crimea will be lost in this particular chapter. But I think if you look over time, I don't think Putin will ultimately come out in any kind of strengthened position. He's presiding over a country that is in decline, demographically, economically, in terms of its international influence, and so forth. And I also think he's revealed his hand. He's the mask has dropped, if you will, and the world now sees how he intends to behave. And I think that will cause a great deal of hedging behavior. I think you'll see countries in Europe that are currently highly dependent on Russia for their energy supplies will start diversifying supplies over time to look more to the United States or to Central Asia or to the Middle East. And so I think he's making his own bed, which eventually will not be beneficial to Russia and will have Russia isolated and weaker and less well off. But in the near term, I think he's made a move that is unlikely to be reversed. He's made a move that, with the help of disinformation through state-owned media, has actually made him more popular at home, tapping into Russian nationalism and sense of grievance post-Cold War. So in the short term, he's the winner, but in the long term, I think he is the loser.
Jim, you're the Supreme Allied Commander at NATO. How do you view the role of NATO in terms of trying to check Russia?
I think Ambassador Burns said that by this move, we're seeing Putin intimidate not only Ukraine, but Moldova and other non-NATO countries. I think he is also intimidating some of the NATO allies. And so we see great concern, given the historical background on the part of the Baltics, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, deep concern on the part of Poland, which is a big, muscular country in the center of Europe. But given their history, they worry about Russia, as well as other former Warsaw Pact nations. So I think that rather than simply being completely quiescent at NATO, it's important that NATO, recognizing that we're not going to go to war over Ukraine, but nonetheless, we can stand with Ukraine from a NATO perspective. So that means sharing intelligence, sharing information, logistics support, weapon sales, potentially moving advisors into Ukraine, which I think actually would have a stabilizing effect. And outside of Ukraine, I think it's important that NATO reaffirm what's called the Article 5 commitment. Article 5 is an article in the NATO treaty, and it is a commitment to support all the NATO allies in the case of an attack or an incursion from outside the alliance. So that needs to be reaffirmed strongly. Ambassador Burns was the U.S. ambassador to NATO, and he knows how sensitive the Eastern Europeans are on this, and Secretary Flournoy has spent a great deal of time in and around the Europeans. I think reassurance is very important, and NATO has a fundamental role in that at this moment.
Again, kind of looking at 1914 and 2014, some historians have compared the United States of today to the Great Britain of 1914, a century ago. A superpower in decline, no longer willing or able to guarantee global security. Is that a fair assessment? Is the United States really leading the world now? What does the United States need to do at this moment? Jim?
I would say the United States is not a superpower in decline. I think what we are witnessing globally is not the decline of the United States, but as some have said, the rise of the rest. We're seeing a China with more capability. We're seeing India rising, a nation we don't talk or think enough about. We're seeing activist behavior on the part of Russia at the moment, and so forth. But if you look at the fundamentals for the United States, they're extremely strong. We have a young and vibrant population. We have a very strong energy position, which is getting better and better as a result of natural gas and fracking. We have high rates of innovation and entrepreneurship. Our graduate and our higher education systems are the envy of the world. If you go to any country in the world and you stand outside the U.S. Embassy, you see people lined up who want to come to the United States of America. That's not a country in decline. However, there are challenges. It's a multipolar world, and we need to be ready using all of our tools, which is diplomacy, our economic power, our military from time to time, our cultural throw weight. All of those things are important. But no, I don't feel the United States is a nation in decline.
Michelle?
I would absolutely agree with that assessment. I think the two things about the current moment are striking. One is Americans are weary of war. We've had more than 13 years of war in Iraq and then Afghanistan, the longest in U.S. history. There is a fatigue out there. That combined with our economic situation, Americans want to focus on getting the economy moving, on improving the situation at home. All of that is incredibly understandable. But I think what we all have to safeguard against in this kind of period is retrenchment. Mm-hmm. It's so tempting to turn inward and just say, I want the world to go away and we want to focus here at home. But every time we've done that in our history, we have lived to regret it. Because we are part, our prosperity, our security, everything depends on the fact that we are part of an interdependent world. And what happens far from our shores reaches and touches us, either positively in terms of economic growth through trade and investment, or negatively, as we all experienced on 9/11. We cannot afford to turn inward. Plus, we still have a unique leadership role to play. There is no other country in the world that can catalyze international action, build coalitions, create common effort to deal with these shared challenges. No other country can play the role that we can play. Doesn't mean we have to always do it alone or be on our own, but we are that catalyst. And when we don't play that role, it hurts us and it hurts the international community.
I just say that I think we have to recognize that in relative terms, as the Admiral was saying, our power has diminished. We don't, at the end of the Second World War, 1950, we had 50% of the world's GDP. That was an unusual time. China, India, Brazil rising. But in absolute terms, we're by far the strongest country in the world. politically, most influential militarily. The three of you know this. You built it. The most powerful. Our soft power. My colleague at Harvard, Joe Nye, says every country has soft power. In our case, the attractiveness of the Constitution. Our freedoms. Hollywood. Silicon Valley. Martin Luther King. It's all part of your soft power.
Dennis Rodman.
Well, yeah.
Well, maybe not.
He is our only ambassador to the North Koreans. So there you go. But
it's a dream.
But there's one kicker, because there's four metrics of power. And I talked about political, military, soft. There's economic power. And I think what we've got to do is make sure that we right the economic ship and that we become a productive manufacturing society and that we don't slide. We deal with our long-term deficits, and no one knows this better than Secretary Panetta, who's director of OMB. Deal with the entitlement programs and the long-term debt we face. That's the Achilles heel of the country. If we can do it successfully and face the hard choices, we will be 50 years from now the strongest country in the world. And I very much agree with Michelle that we've got to have the confidence of leadership, and we've got to be outward looking and not draw into ourselves the way we have so often, isolationism, which I think is a problem.
There's been a lot of questions raised. We've seen Russia and the United States jockeying in different parts of the world about what exactly are the rules? What are the international rules that guide us here, particularly with regards to sovereignty versus self-rule? 1999, Kosovo seceded from Serbia. Washington supported Kosovo doing that. Russia said it infringed on Serbian sovereignty. 15 years later, Russia says Crimea has the right to break away from the Ukraine, and the United States says that would violate Ukrainian sovereignty. Scotland's going to vote soon to break from London, Catalonia from Spain. Quebec periodically votes to break away from Canada. Is there a right and wrong when it comes to sovereignty versus self-rule? What's the definition as to when you're right? Mr. Ambassador. Well,
thanks for that softball question. This is the hardest question tonight. So I think it's pretty clear. The United Nations holds sacrosanct the sovereignty of a country and that country's borders. And that's the Westphalian state system that's emerged over the last couple of hundred years. But countries have a right to change. And people living in one region of a country have a right in a democratic system to decide they're going to leave. And so the people of Quebec have had that opportunity. They've chosen to stay within Canada. The people of the Czechoslovakia decided to separate into two countries by a democratic process. And what Putin has done is he went into Crimea because he could, sovereign Ukrainian territory, put his troops in and just took it. And last week he said, well, I'm not going to take it for Russia. I'm just protecting these people. Now he's going to hold a trumped-up referendum this weekend. And you know what the result's going to be because he's an authoritarian leader. He'll annex Crimea. That's not the way to do it because those people won't be able to vote freely because they're living under an occupation. So I think the difference here is if it could be done on a democratic basis through a free and fair vote, and I hope Scotland doesn't secede from the United Kingdom, but if it does, it'll be a fair process. You don't take it by military force. And the one thing I'll say about Kosovo, it's an exception. There was a bitter war there, and Slobodan Milosevic, an indicted war criminal, tried to expel, ethnically cleanse, 1 million Muslim Kosovo Albanians from Kosovo. And it had not been for President Clinton, who stopped him from doing that through the use of U.S. military force, he would have changed that country forever. Kosovo, by 2008, when it became independent and the United States recognized it, was 95% Muslim and 5% Serbian. And they weren't going to go back and stay in the country that had tried to annihilate them. So I think that's a big exception, and there's no comparison with what we've done versus what Putin's done, in my judgment.
Any other comments? Let me ask you this. Putin, I think we've all agreed, is likely to win this part of the game in the short term. And there's going to be a lot of concern. I mean, history will kind of look back and say, well, you know, did the world basically allow Putin to get away with this? If you were advising the president as to how to check Putin and Russia at this point. In other words, be able to effectively send a message to Putin that he's not going to get away with it and that he shouldn't do this again. What are the two or three things you'd say to the president that need to be done?
Well, I would start by saying we don't have an effective military tool to play here. We're not going to go to war about this. We're not going to close in on the borders of Russia. We're not going to conduct big exercises. We're not going to move nuclear weapons around. I just don't think that's a productive role for us to play. I think you have to go after what Putin cares about. One thing, in fact, is his own image in the international world. So I think a concerted effort that really portrays him in appropriately very dark ways is an effective place to start. That's a political and a cultural message. Secondly, and I think perhaps most strongly, you go after the economy and the ruble and the gas and oil. The Russian economy is a one-trick pony, and 70% of their revenues come from hydrocarbons. Now, that'll be initially painful to the West, and six European countries are 100% dependent on Russian gas. Another six have over 50% dependency. So there'll be pain initially, and as Secretary Flournoy has said, the flow of U.S. natural gas can't solve this crisis. It'll solve the next crisis. But I think looking at a serious sanctions regime is something that ought to be considered. It'll be controversial for a variety of different reasons. And then a third thing I think you do is you go after other places where Russia has vested interests around the world, things that they want to try and accomplish, and you try and position so that you can block those, working with allies. The more you can build a concerted global position against this, the more effective you would be.
Cheryl, anything?
I agree with that. I think the one thing I would add is there are many places where we've sought to cooperate with Russia to solve problems. Sometimes we have very much aligned interests, as in the case of North Korea and the nuclear arsenal there. But in a place like Syria, I think we've tried to bent over backwards trying to keep Russia on board, trying to get Russia to push for a negotiated solution and so forth. I think post-Ukraine, the prospect for Russian cooperation on resolving the Syria situation is virtually nil.
Yeah,
and so I think U.S. policy going forward on Syria needs to assume that you're not going to get any help whatsoever from Russia. What's the best way to address the humanitarian tragedy that's unfolding there, address the problem of Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups taking root right in the heart of the Middle East, and try to contain the problem to prevent a broader Sunni-Shia civil war that starts to destabilizing the countries on the periphery of Syria, as we're seeing in Iraq and Lebanon and so forth. So I think we need to be clear-eyed about the prospect of Russian cooperation elsewhere as we go forward.
Any other thoughts? No?
Only that, and I agree with everything that both Jim and Michelle have said, only that we're doing very well in reaffirming our commitment to NATO. We've done very well with the Europeans in getting early support to the new Ukrainian government, $16 billion of aid, $15 billion of which is European. We're not doing well in driving up the cost to Putin, which is the president's stated goal. I think the president's tried to handle this very well. The president and the East Europeans, the people who live closest to Putin, want a tough pushback economically. The West Europeans don't, for the reasons cited by my colleagues, and we are divided from them, so it's a weaker response than we would like.
All right, you know, let me raise this with you because it's symptomatic to what's happening in Washington these days, is there's a lot of finger-pointing as to who's to blame for what's happening in the Ukraine. Republicans are criticizing the president for having failed to act aggressively in Syria, and that sent a message of weakness around the world with regards to the red line, failure to kind of back up that red line that he drew there. Democrats are saying that actually President Bush, by virtue of going into Iraq, sent the wrong message to the world and to Russia that they could do whatever they wanted to do as long as the United States did whatever we wanted to do. And others have said that Putin would have gone in no matter who the hell was president of the United States, as he did in past times. So who do you blame? Or does anybody bear the blame?
I think, and we talked about this earlier amongst ourselves, but I think the person to blame is Vladimir Putin. And and the other person is Yanukovych. Crime is where opportunity meets motive, and motive is Putin, who has strategic reasons for doing this, which Ambassador Burns and Secretary Flournoy have elucidated. And on the opportunity side, Yanukovych created this opportunity through his grotesque mismanagement of the Ukrainian economy, his corruption, his personal greed, his utter mismanagement of the scenario during the initial uprisings, and his fundamental decision to walk away from the European Union. So I think an awful lot of the blame is right there.
Agree, and there's the old adage that politics should stop at the water's edge, and that's not happening. That was a partisan response last week. And you said it, Mr. Secretary, when Putin went into Georgia in 2008 to take Abkhazia and South Ossetia, sovereign Georgian territory, away from Georgia, that was on George W. Bush's watch, and no one accused George W. Bush ever of being a weak president, especially when it came to military force. But he did not react militarily the way President Obama is not reacting militarily, because that's the right thing to do. We have to play a longer game. Putin's won the first couple of rounds, but we, in the end, if we can drive up the costs and isolate him, have a chance. So I think that it's time to really rally around the president. That might sound like an antique and quaint and maybe naive notion, but it's a major foreign crisis, and Americans ought to unite behind their president at a time like this.
If I could just add on that. When you travel overseas, it's very upsetting and disconcerting to our allies when they see this kind of political division, when the politics don't stop at the water's edge. And our rivals, competitors, frenemies, however you want to term various states, they take advantage of it. They pick up the critical narrative, and they start using it to, you know, influence others, to try to draw friends away from us, to try to portray the U.S. as divided and weak. So this hurts us. It's not only a sort of, you know, something that is, it's a sort of a norm that we're violating, if you will. It really hurts us abroad.
You know, we've looked at this as one flashpoint. There are a lot of other flashpoints in the world, and let's try to check each of those as we talk about, you know, the potential for greater conflict. The historian Margaret McMillan suggested that the Middle East of 2014 is similar to the Balkans of 1914, and we've seen turmoil, obviously, in the Middle East, from Tunisia to Egypt to Syria. Let's focus on Syria for the moment. We all agree it's chaotic. 140,000 dead, but 9 million refugees that are flowing into other countries. There's probably 800,000 people under siege within that country itself. Assad seems to be in a stronger place than he was with the help of the Russians. The U.S., frankly, has appeared to be ambivalent about just exactly what it would do in Syria. Michelle, you mentioned this, but, you know, let me ask all of you, should the U.S. be taking a stronger position in Syria in order to try to have some influence over the direction of that chaos?
I think so. I think the time has come to, particularly given, as Michelle said, the possibility of sorting this out with Russian support in the UN Security Council is diminishing. I tend to agree that now is not the time for U.S. boots on the ground, but is time for additional aid to the opposition. I think we have developed a more nuanced view of who are the groups we can support, who are those that we can't support, and there are those we really can't support. But as a choice, and these are bad choices, but as a choice between doing nothing and trying to help the positive side of the opposition, I think the time has come to lean in and help the positive side of the opposition.
I would agree that with that wholeheartedly, and there's a lot more that we can do in terms of assisting and training and equipping the opposition to be more effective. But I also think we need to start looking at what's happening in Syria through a counterterrorism lens as well. I would agree that this is not a situation you want to have a U.S. military boots on the ground intervention, but we have developed a number of tools over the last decade to track and try to disrupt the financing of these more radical groups. Their supply lines, their travel, their movement of people across borders. Al-Qaeda is developing a new safe haven in the heart of the Middle East, and we have got to be focused on trying to prevent that and preventing the destabilizing effects that's happening in places like Iraq, in Lebanon, potentially Jordan. And so I think a more concerted focus on arming and assisting the opposition and influencing the outcome within Syria, but also really attending to this growing al-Qaeda safe haven in the area and trying to keep the other countries around Syria off the chessboard, keep them from being destabilized by what's going on there.
I think we have a strategic interest in not seeing the Syrian civil war develop into a regional war that could affect Israel and Jordan and Turkey and Lebanon and Iraq. Think of where Syria is geopolitically. And that could happen, given the dimensions of the fighting. And we also have a moral and humanitarian interest. It's the most important humanitarian crisis of this year, of recent times. Nearly half the people of the country are now refugees in their own country, or they've been driven out. And like my colleagues, I don't think anybody really supports an American military offensive into Syria. But can we help with getting humanitarian access, getting NGOs in the UN, maybe use our military power to carve out humanitarian exclusion zones? And should the president have used air power last September against Assad's air force? Yes. The president drew a line in the sand, literally. He said, Assad must go. If Assad uses chemical weapons, I will react. Assad used chemical weapons twice. The president didn't react. And I have great respect for the president, and I admire him, but I think that was not his finest moment. Because in the Middle East, particularly brutal people like Assad, the Iranians, and we should not want the Iranians to win, they respect and understand one thing, power. And we're more powerful, but we didn't act like it. So I think we have a deficit there.
Can I add one thought on that? On Syria, because we haven't mentioned it, another very complex dimension is that it's a conflict between Sunni and Shia within Islam. These are two sects within the faith. Assad representing the Shia side, actually Alawis in Syria, and of course the opposition is principally Sunni, but within Syria, this same Sunni-Shia split is playing out in Lebanon and Iraq, and then in a surrogate sense between Iran, the leading Shia state, and Saudi Arabia, the leading Sunni state. So for all the reasons that the ambassador and the secretary mentioned, the potential for this to crack open into a larger war within the Arab Islamic world, I think cannot be ignored. And as I always say to largely Christian audiences, we've seen this movie before. This is the Wars of the Reformation, Catholics and Protestants, which lasted 150 years and killed a third of the population of Europe. So I think this is a very grave situation, and the more we can do to kind of contain it within Syria, the better.
Let me ask you before we turn to questions from the audience on Iran. Iran, we know, is another one of those flashpoints in the Middle East. Iran has a history of assisting terrorism around the world, of creating instability over five continents, They are involved, obviously, helping Assad in Syria. I think it's fair to say they have represented a really opposing force in that part of the world in terms of the way they've behaved. They obviously are trying to develop a nuclear capability. They've got a lot of centrifuges that have the potential to produce enriched fuel. There was concern that at one point they were moving towards actually developing an atomic weapon. Intelligence tells us that they backed off of that decision. But the world came together, sanctions were applied. Iran elected a more moderate president, Rouhani, and now we're in negotiations. And the first interim agreement was kind of just to freeze everything, which, you know, a good step. But now they're going to be meeting for really trying to decide whether or not Iran will, in fact, either significantly reduce or eliminate their nuclear capability when it comes to developing enriched fuel. They're obviously resisting. And I guess my question is, you know, what are the chances that Iran ultimately would agree to something, you know, that is pretty significant for them, basically, you know, eliminating all of this these centrifuges that they've developed? And if this is a stalling tactic, what are the chances that either Israel or the United States would have to go to war?
Well, I would assess the probability of a success in these negotiations maybe at 30 or 40%. The president put it at 50-50. I understand why he wants to do that. I think the president has done a really good job of getting us where we are. And it's a rare moment of bipartisanship because President Bush, and I worked for him on this issue, established this framework that, you know, you want to sanction them to get to the negotiating table, but you want to negotiate. You want to try diplomacy first. You don't want to go to try war first. And President Obama has strengthened that policy. And so Iran's at the table because their oil production is down 1 million barrels a day. And because they have problems with the hyperinflation of their currency, the rial. And so they want to integrate with the rest of the world. They want to participate economically. They don't want to be a recluse like North Korea. So we've found how to motivate them. It's going to be difficult, however, because we're going to have to insist that they dismantle part of their nuclear apparatus. They're spinning 19,000 centrifuges in their enrichment plants. That's going to have to come down to single-digit thousands, if not less. They have an IROC heavy water reactor, which is an alternative route to a nuclear weapon through the production of plutonium. I would say that's going to have to be shut down. And the administration is going to be very tough-minded. And I guess I wonder if the Iranians will accept that kind of a deal. And if they do accept it at the negotiating table, will the Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei and the Revolutionary Guards back home essentially say, okay, we'll do this and we'll implement it? So I think for that reason, you can't be optimistic, but the president is doing exactly the right thing, and he's been artful in getting the Russians and Chinese to help us here.
Michelle.
The Iranians have to be made to understand that they really face a fork in the road. Either they curtail their nuclear program and get back into compliance with all of their obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty and so forth, or they face a future of continued pressure that will prevent their integration into the global economy, that will hurt the quality of life of their people, their economy, their currency, and so forth. I mean, if this deal doesn't occur, in a rare act of bipartisan support, you're going to see the U.S. Congress immediately up the sanctions. You are going to see even more pressure put on Iran. And I think you'll see other coercive measures come into play. You will also see, I think, the state of Israel extremely anxious and potentially moving closer to the use of force. And I think ultimately there's a very strong commitment on the part of this administration not to allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon because of its support for terrorism and destabilizing activities throughout the region, and because we think it would begin a whole cascade of proliferation. If there's an Iranian Shia bomb, Saudi Arabia may feel compelled to pursue a Sunni bomb, and then others will react to that. So this is a huge issue, and in a region as tumultuous as the Middle East, we do not want to be seeing a proliferation of nuclear arsenals in that geography.
I would just add the key for the president is going to be how this negotiation comes out. I give it at best a 1 in 5 chance of success, and then the president will have a very difficult choice. I think it'll come on his watch. It'll happen in the next 3 years. I would only add to what you have both said, and I agree with it, that there are other steps between sanctions and all-out combat, which would include cyber, some special forces, some CIA types of things, which might ratchet up. But it becomes a very unattractive set of choices if this negotiation fails, and it probably will.
Just one last point. This is such an important issue. And the use of force, if it came to that, and we hope it won't, would not be strategic in the sense that you can't do away with human knowledge about how to construct a nuclear device, how to enrich uranium. It would be tactical in the sense we'd be trying to get them to come back to the negotiating table by using military force. So I think ultimately, and here the last two presidents have agreed on this, George W. Bush and especially President Obama, ultimately we're going to have to try to negotiate an end to this weapon at some time or another.